All right, this is Alex Fellows. This is your first podcast on the Really Rich Podcast. What we do is basically I try to show you that the path to success is an ugly, crazy, winding road. So, oh, and by the way, not everyone's an entrepreneur. So Alex is what I like to call an intrapreneur. What that means is he started a business, built a business inside an existing company, a growing company, Diplomatico Rum. It's an interesting brand. It's an interesting story. It's a family run business. And it's as close as you can get to being in a startup without being in a startup. So before we get started, guys, if it's your first time here, click the like, slap the subscribe button. We gotta get you into our ecosystem here. It helps us out a lot. And you know, we're on all channels now: Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all that good stuff. So Alex and I know each other for quite a while. So this is, we'll see how wide ranging this conversation goes. So we're just gonna, I want to just hear, Alex, like in your own words, like what do you do at Diplomatico? Give us just a little bit of background.
Sure. Yeah. So I've been in the spirits business, well, the AlcBev business for about the last 12 years. A little more kind of a random introduction was working in marketing prior to that, and found my way into one of my first jobs on the wine side at an agency, and kind of just fell in love with the products. The storytelling of these brands is just so awesome. And that's really what you're looking for when you work in marketing, is that capital that you can really run with and talk to consumers and stakeholders about. So long story short, stayed in the industry for about 12 years. And 5 years ago, I made the transition, the jump from agency side over to the brand side, working at Diplomatico, which was also, you know, everyone says it's who you know, and I wouldn't argue with that. But the last couple of jobs I've gotten have been online applications. I kind of stumbled upon this job. I had heard of the brand, wasn't super familiar, but
not nepotism, everybody.
No.
You actually have to apply to a job every once in a while.
Yeah. Important to note that a family company as well. But I stumbled upon this company, this brand, and it was just in this really special moment of their growth. Kind of crazy. Started off with an importer that they were working with in the U.S. Back in 2018. And 6 months into that, was asked to come work in-house and navigate a transition over to another commercial partner in the U.S. who we've been working with for about the last 4 years. And then
explain, like, how does this stuff show up in the United States from Venezuela? How does it go from a cask in Venezuela to a freaking, you know, bottle in the liquor store on Collins Ave in South Beach,
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a crazy journey for a lot. I mean, the CPG business is crazy in that aspect. Supply chain these days is so multifaceted and global. So it's pretty astounding how products get put together and brought to market. But the alcohol business is no different. And yeah, especially with the regulation we have in the U.S., it's even more crazy. The amount of hands that it goes through to get to that liquor store on Collins Ave is just nuts. But so we actually do our bottling in Panama. So the liquid is produced in Venezuela, it goes over to Panama. And then after that, it makes its way to the United States. And we have an alcohol business in the U.S. We have a three-tier system. So we have state-level distributors. So there's a licensed importer that brings it in, or supplier, and then that gets sold to the wholesaler, who then sells it to the liquor store, that sells it to Nick and Alex to drink on the weekends.
Okay. So. And everybody in this whole thing has to make some money.
Yeah. And that's the price model is not friendly for young brands. That's the craziest part. I mean, it's hard to penetrate as a young brand with limited resources. So it's part of the testament to what Diplomatico has accomplished. Certainly it's a global brand. You know, most of the volume actually is overseas in Europe, but what the brand has been able to accomplish with its resources is really special.
So this podcast is going to drop in February. So we're clear out of dry January. Everyone's ready to reach for something.
Yeah, there you go.
Do you think that the reason Diplomatico had so much success, like, what do you point to? Like, is it just the straight up juice in the bottle that people are like, okay, that's an elevated rum? Because, you know, I've worked with you before. I've obviously tasted Diplomatico. Yeah, it's really stuff. Great stuff. Like, were you product led? Were you? Because I mean, there's a lot of facets that go into the process. Like, There's the story. There's the way that the product looks on the shelf, right? What do you think really made you guys stand out in, like, you know, it's not as crowded as vodka space, but it's pretty freaking crowded.
Yeah, rum is a weird business because when, I mean, weird isn't the right word, but it's a transitioning business and it's very much dominated by the value and standard price segments. I mean, the Bacardis and Captain Morgans of the world make up 95% of the category.
Stuff you're going to like mix with Coca-Cola and throw in a cooler. And
Right. Know. It's nothing bad to talk about those brands. I mean, those brands are amazing products and run by amazing organizations. But the rum business in the premium sense didn't really exist, and it's still very much growing to be, you know, what it will be in the future. But you know, at the time that Diplomático came on the scene, it was really slim pickings for brands. I mean, right. Zacapa was one of the only other players in the premium space, mm-hmm. which is owned by Diageo. And you know, I think, to your question about what really drove the success, I think, yeah, I mean, the liquid first and foremost is, you know, amazing. It's super smooth. Everyone that tries it, it's like that light bulb moment brand. When you try it, it's like, I'm not a rum person. You put it in your mouth and you're like, wow.
Yeah, this is pretty good.
Yeah, it's, you know, oh, I didn't know I liked rum. And it just changes the story for you as far as rum. Actually, one of the campaigns that was running when I first joined the brand was rediscover rum, discover Diplomático, trying to play on that idea that this isn't what you think about rum. This is a totally different type of product. But yeah, liquid and packaging is just so good. Iconic, very vintage feel, very recognizable on the back bar or on the shelf. So I think that those two kind of obviously fundamental ingredients for any type of product like this really drove a lot of success. But I think the special sauce for Diplo was really, and it sounds a little cliche, but because it's just something that a lot of people probably throw into their marketing campaigns and the way that they communicate, but it's the personal touch. It's a family company. And the families that built it really built it brick by brick. They were all super hands-on, up to the CEO, out and about in the market, really spreading the love and putting the bottle on the bar and shaking hands and inviting people they'd meet over to their houses for barbecues and birthday parties. And
so totally word of mouth effort for how long? How old is the brand?
They've been at it for about 20 years now. Okay.
So it's still not 100+ year legacy brand where you're just like, at this point, they know they have every single line into every single distributor.
Yeah, the brand, yeah, no. The brand itself, no. You know, the storyline of the spirits industry and the families that founded the brand dates back far before that.
Okay.
They were in Venezuela, many of whom were working in the spirits and industry there. And, you know, they had the opportunity to buy a distillery that was formerly owned by Seagram's in La Miel, Venezuela, which Diageo had acquired from Seagram's. Seagram's was like the Diageo back in the day. They were the biggest, you know, baddest spirit supplier globally at the time. And they liquidated they got out of the alcohol business. They sold the brands to Diageo Pernod Ricard, and Diageo acquired this plant, but didn't really want to, after a little while, they realized they didn't want to be in the operations. Mm. They didn't want to operate this plant. So long story short, the families had an opportunity to buy it, and Diplomático was one of the brands that they acquired with the distillery. So it did exist, but it was nothing. I mean, it was very, very, it was peanuts, small volume, only sold in Venezuela, and they saw it as an opportunity and took it and started to export it and really grew it into something.
Right. That great. Is. So how did you apply to you see the job, you're like, okay, I've seen this on the shelf. I've had it at the bar before. This is a pretty cool brand, right? You go in for the interview. Are you like the first major brand hire for these guys? Like, because I know that they did a huge push. You just started seeing Diplomático more and more, quite frankly, in the United States. So were you kind of the guy that they brought on to be like, here's a chunk of budget. You have carte blanche. Like, what the figure this thing out. Like when you showed up, how'd you figure it out? Because you guys just got acquired, right? So
yeah, we just got acquired by Brown-Forman, which is a top five supplier in the world by volume and value. They own Jack Daniel's, which is the number one American whiskey globally. So.
Right. And the number one hangover producer in the United States of America. No. So like shout out to Jack Daniel's guys. I guess what I'm saying is you showed up in this period where they're like, okay, clearly there's a huge push, a huge investment to get this thing as big and as ready as possible to join a portfolio like that you mentioned, right? To sit along the sides of the big dogs like Jack Daniel's. Like, what? How did you approach that challenge? Because it's kind of like building a business like inside another business. The only difference is you have someone gives you money immediately to go and spend. How'd you pull that off?
Yeah, I mean, I think I definitely came on and like I said, in that kind of pivotal moment of crazy growth.
Well, COVID helped out a lot too.
Oh yeah. I mean, COVID, bittersweet as it was for our on-premise partners, meaning the kind of the bars and restaurant world.
Right.
We lost a lot of business and a lot of our partners and friends there struggled immensely over the last few years, but retail wise, we boomed. I mean, we, over the last 5 years in the US, we've tripled essentially in volume and distribution. So,
wow. That's how many people were taking it back home, taking the party back home. Right?
Yeah. I mean, volumetrically, I mean, you sell 16 roughly cocktails in a bar. That's one purchase at retail. Mm. And, you know, it's a different, you know, shopper sometimes and it's different occasion, but, I think, you know, initially we worried in COVID that people were going to trade down, people were losing their jobs, worried about money, but we actually saw the inverse happen. People were spending less at bars, less at restaurants, going out, all the extracurricular activities, and they're actually trading up. So we were actually not just seeing overconsumption, which, you know, the pantry loading and all that stuff that people were talking about, but it was also new recruitment of drinkers who were seeing it on the shelves, trying it for the first time.
Hmm. Okay, so let's go back now. You show up, you turn up in this environment. Like, what was your toolkit? What was your game plan like? Was it influencer marketing? Like, what are some of the building blocks that you put together to pull this off?
Yeah, it's in the spirit of kind of the entrepreneurial discussion. I think, you know, I never had, you know, unlimited resources with Diplomatico despite our success. I think, you know, we were always very conscious and had a lot of guardrails up in terms of our financial management, fiscally, very, very global oriented. You know, one successful market helped kind of provide the resources to build other emerging markets.
Right.
So, you know, it's not like you sold way more, you could spend way more necessarily.
Right.
But, you know, I think that the way that the team approached the business, like I said, from a personal standpoint, they really had that kind of instilled that entrepreneurial culture and spirit into the team.
Okay.
Which I think really valued, incentivized, you know, an innovative approach to doing things. And innovation and creativity is not synonymous with big budgets. Obviously, big budgets help to be able to do cool stuff. But I think that the way that they really kind of nurtured that culture of innovation within the company, allowed people to really run with their ideas and bring cool ideas to the table that would produce growth for the brand.
Okay.
So I, you know, it's being kind of this entrepreneur within a company, and, you know, it's kind of like having your cake and eating it too. You can, you can kind of operate almost as a stakeholder, a business owner, someone who has, you know, vested interest in the brand while, not having as much of the financial risk, maybe risk of losing your job at the end of the day. But the idea of entrepreneurship really starts with the company.
Okay.
I think that the company really has to instill this.
How do they do that? Is your job description 10 pages long or is it 3 sentences? Like how does a business empower you guys to go out and be scrappy and think that way? Because what you're describing is, you know, hey, if you've got the European market, if you've got the Latin American market leading the way, you could slice off a little piece for the US of A, right? That's bootstrapping in its basic way. I mean, that's how I build my businesses, as opposed to going and raising shitloads of money and giving away, you know, half of the company, right? It's like, okay, well, I've got a little piece over here, I can move this over here. So, like, how do you, like, what's that roadmap look like? Like, how did you approach that? Because there's so many people that are listening, they're like, dude, I'm not an entrepreneur. Okay, but I can be entrepreneurial in my career.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. There's no, like, I've seen you say this before, there's no golden road for success. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think a lot of it's trial and testing and learning. I do think that, and startups have kind of paved the way for this kind of innovative way of thinking too. You can't just show up with the rinse and repeat approach to everything. You can't show up to a board meeting proposing to do the same thing over and over again. So I think that these small companies, they do need to kind of culture this, you know, produce this culture of innovation by incentivizing innovation and being able to tolerate a little bit of risk too.
Right. Cause you guys have to break some shit in the process of growing, right? Like some mistakes.
Yeah. And I think it's tolerating risk, but also understanding your brand and amplifying the things that make you really unique. You know, unique is a term that people throw around all the time that they've kind of lost touch with what it really means. I mean, unique means you're special in certain ways likely at the detriment of other aspects of your brand. I mean, you can't be everything to everybody. Mm-hmm. And that's like, you know, the business status quo kind of thinking, best practices thinking, is that we want to polish and round every aspect of our brand, every aspect of our business, be everything to everybody. And obviously a lot of great brands don't do this, and arguably that's a lot to do with what and how successful they are. But you know, I think you need to identify and lean into those weird aspects to your brand. Mm-hmm. And that kind of way of thinking, you know, translates to the people that you hire too. I mean, I think finding people, you know, there's that kind of best practices of wanting to hire the most well-rounded candidate, right?
Right.
You know, hire the candidate that can do everything. And then the things that they can't do super well, well, we're going to give them training. We're going to give them these resources, and mm-hmm. we're going to help them polish and get better at admin and get better at these things that they hate doing or they're not good at doing. But really you should be orienting your company towards these weird, unique qualities, and then finding the resources, the team, building the team around their strengths. Right. And I think that, you know, that's part of what kind of I experienced in Diplomatico, you know, caveat being that we were a small team and I did have to do things that I didn't want to do. And, you know, maybe I wasn't as good at, but you learn as you go along the way.
And one of the, I think, more unique aspects of your job is your job is pretty much in Spanish.
Yeah. Right?
Like, so, you know, guys, we talk about, like, you know, putting together this magical a basket of skills. If you're bilingual, or if you're, you know, for you, if you've been a student, you've been speaking Spanish for a long time, basically started through just traveling, going, wait, I like living in Argentina. I think I'm gonna learn how to speak Spanish, because if I could speak Spanish, I'm gonna make more friends and I'm gonna have even more fun. Right. Just kind of a simple
life is serendipitous sometimes. Yeah. It's funny. Like, I went and lived in South America for 2 years after college, and, you know, some supported me, some didn't. Some said, you know, throw my life away, go get a job, sit in a cubicle, do the corporate ladder thing. And
you were chilling pretty hard in South America. Like, you were figuring out what the hell it is you wanted to do at that point, right?
Yeah, I was chilling, but, you know, and having the time of my life, of course. You know, I was in my early 20s and meeting lots of people and traveling around one of the most amazing parts of the world. But I don't want to say ironically, because you'd think, you know, you're that age, you're just partying and doing whatever. But mm-hmm. I was also super oriented and driven to be productive and do cool things work-wise while I was there. I had several different jobs while I was there, both in Chile and Argentina, working in marketing and different types of things, and nothing like, you know, high level or super demanding.
Right.
But it really kind of started to connect the dots for me mentally in terms of, oh, well, I'm speaking Spanish. Oh, I'm doing marketing. Oh, I'm, you know, learning about these different parts of the world and these different cultures. And mm-hmm. it's funny because, you know, I came back and my introduction, I said it was random to the spirits business, to the wine, the AlcBev business, but the bridge was really that Spanish language skill, because I came back and the agency I actually started working for was looking for someone to speak with their clients in Spanish.
Right.
So that was kind of my introduction. And now Diplomatico, Venezuelan company, I'm like the only gringo within the company. It's pretty, it's pretty amazing.
But you're a gringo who can hang officially.
I do my best. I have my moments, but it's,
you're one of the good ones.
Yeah. They've accepted me into their clan.
it's one of those things, right? It's a strange winding journey where you pick up Spanish basically to experiment, right? Because you're down there, you're traveling, but you're also experimenting what you're interested in. There's no like formal program that you joined, you know, young gringos in Latin America program, learn who you want to be when you grow up. Like you just freaking go down there and figure it out. You know, yeah. I wish I did that. You know that I did end up doing that, but I ended up doing it after working for like 8 years, you know, and the joy there was I had a lot of money to blow through, but it was really sad because I could have started off learning a lot more about myself in the first place, like, yeah. You know, in a cool place. And yeah, I bet my Spanish would be a lot freaking better than it is right now.
Might help in Miami.
Help in Miami because, yeah, pretty sure it's you like don't actually need here. To speak English here ever. Not once. Yeah.
Maybe in Brickell, but that's about it.
Nice.
You know, everyone's journey is a little bit different. I feel very fortunate that I took the plunge. I mean, those programs, albeit maybe less romantic way of getting out of there right. And getting, you know, into another country. If it's what pushes you to go there, go for it. I think that, you know, part of the reason why I stayed motivated to have these work experiences when I was traveling and why I've carried a lot of these amazing experiences with me for so long is that I think the language piece. You know, people say that when you learn a language, it definitely like it opens up your mind. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like exercise for your brain.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty crazy. Like I'll spend a week on some of these work trips. We do a week trip annually over to Europe to do some meetings with the team. And, you know, I'm speaking Spanish for a week straight. And it's like,
right.
You know, mental aerobics. And I've gotten better at it over the years. But still, there's, you know, days you get back to your hotel room and you're just like zonked.
Right.
So it's like, you know, that level of kind of mental, you know, using your mind in new ways, it kind of, I don't know, it just, it pushed me to want to be, you know, soak up everything and be more curious about my work. And I don't know, it's kind of instilled us kind of a level of, I don't know, curiosity, ambition in me that I've really carried with me over the years.
Yeah, that's awesome. I just think that there's like, what ends up happening is if you follow this thread of your interest, eventually, and you keep doing that, eventually you wind up in a place where you feel comfortable, where you're like, okay, well, I like it down here. I like speaking Spanish. I like working in this capacity. And by the way, in early on, right, you're just dabbling. You're getting paid. You're not even worried about what you're getting paid. You're like, I just need to be able to sleep here and eat food and have some beer on the side when I need it, right? Like, yeah, instead of running right in, like what I did is I was like, what is the most money I can make the second I graduate college? Like, not saying anything about what do I want to do? What do I like? You know, I had interned in a pretty big marketing agency in New York as I think that was my first internship. This was like a freshman or sophomore, and I loved it. And I just remember they brought me in, the CEO at the time, he brought me in to her office, and she said, Nick, we love you. We want to hire you. Do you know how much you're going to make?
$30K.
Yeah. And I just said,
New York City.
I was like, I don't really think that that's possible for me to do that. And of course, that was short-sighted thinking because I love that job. And I was around the best and the brightest. I mean, the guy that created we had American Express, we had Mini Cooper, we had Verizon, I think. There were like just huge accounts. And I was like, well, you know what? If I made that $30K for a year or two, I probably would be opening up my own ad agency in 3 or 4 years, you know? And, you know, that would have been a nice quick road to a couple million bucks doing some fun, working on stuff I really liked.
Yeah, man. I mean, like I said, every road is a little different. I mean, yours may have been like slightly inverse from mine. You know, I went and had the weird experience early on that led me to where I am now, where I'm like perhaps more focused on trying to make money. Not saying obviously, you know, we're not all focused on trying to make money, but I think you had a different experience that opened your eyes in a way that was special and unique to you. So I think at the end of the day, it just comes down to being self-aware and, you know, true to like what it is that you're interested in, what matters to you, what your values are. And
right.
Like you said, putting one step in front of the other, it's not all going to connect and gel right out of the gate. You got to kind of put one brick on top of another. And, you know, eventually the picture starts to come into focus.
Right. Yeah. I mean, also, I think there's this weird phenomenon when you're making money doing something that you don't like, it doesn't even feel good. You're like, yeah, I've got so much money and I just, something doesn't feel good. That was this weird, it was this weird phenomenon that was happening to me towards the end of my career on Wall Street. It's like Wall Street was the ultimate education for me. It was the ultimate like bucket of cold water in the face after college. But it was like, why don't I feel good about making this much money? Like, why doesn't this, like, why can't I savor this? And when when I break it into its pieces, it's a couple things. It's like, well, most of your day is doing something that, you know, you're okay at, you know, and then it's, well, and then the lifestyle, I need to be able to get up and move in the course of my day, dude. I can't be sitting stuck to five computers.
Yeah, I hate that.
And that's basically the life of someone on a trading floor is like, you know, you're running to use the bathroom. You're eating a freaking chopped salad over your keyboard, which starts to, like, you want to talk about, like, you have to clean that surface of the keyboard. Like, those keyboards would be the first place to look for, like, just new.
Not just salad dressing.
Not just, just horrible things. Yeah. You have to be really careful when you go to a trading floor and see those disgusting keyboards. But the lifestyle was never going to be, for me, it's too sedentary. Like, there's getting around, moving around, like, jumping in the podcast, like, going home, like, seeing producer Andy having a good time over there, you know, like, this is all part of the fun. It's exciting. And okay, well, then next part of my day is, okay, I drop in and I work on my book that we're going to market with next week. Okay, I drop in, I do some fast outreach.ai tweaks and modifications. It's like, it's an active freaking existence, right?
Yeah, but as much as you're happy to have that rhythm, that part of your life in your rearview mirror, you know, it's integral to who you are and how successful you are right now. I mean, if you jump into it, like what you're doing as an entrepreneur or like a small company like Diplomatico, or, you know, try to start your own thing, it's way harder if you haven't cut your teeth in some way, shape or form at a larger organization. I mean, as much as these larger organizations are the bane of our existence as it relates to, you know, certain things like process and politics and certain things, they got a lot of things right. And there's a reason why they're so successful. And there's a lot you can learn. They're good universities for us, or schools for us, to really take a lot of those, you know, most important things and apply them to what we're doing.
Okay, completely agreed. And I don't think I emphasize this enough. It's like, you said it, like universities, it's like there's school and then there's the real, then it's like job school. And going to a big company and starting out in an established company, which might not be as cool as the hip friggin' 10 people company down the street, right? Out of a loft where the founder is sleeping like 10 feet from you, right?
How cool that is.
I don't know. That seems a little weird, to be honest with you. But it's like, okay, well, now you learn how scale looks and operates, and you get really serious. And I think you can get really smart if you're paying attention, really absorbing everything. The intensity that I picked up on Wall Street, like, that is still here in full force. That never changed, you know, to better for worse, depending on who you are in my life. But that is something I learned on Wall. I was like, holy crap, people act like this. People think like this. And then I said, well, if I act like this and think like this, of course, the good side, not the terrible side. You know, I don't want to look like the rich character, not the really rich character here when I talk about this, but it's like, no, that intensity is so valuable to just getting things done really fast.
Yeah. And it's your own personal, it helps you kind of structure your own personal process too. Cause like to your question earlier about not really having a job description. I mean, like no one's given, I mean, I did have multiple bosses over the last 5 years in Diplomatico, but very hands off. And, you know, it was an amazing relationship that was very collaborative, but I didn't have people, you know, handing me deadlines for every task I had to do. I didn't give myself those deadlines. So it's like that kind of self-inflicted process rigor that you need in order to stay on track. I mean, yeah, you have your roadmap, and you can veer off side to side, you know, prioritize and be agile, flexible, but you need to have some kind of map,
right?
Some kind of like process for yourself to stay on track. Otherwise, it's chaos.
Do you think that everyone can handle that blank job description, or do you think there's people? I have my own belief here, but there's some people that want to be handed a hard roadmap. And when they don't have a hard roadmap, they call you up and they say, hey, can we talk?
Well, I think 100% there's people that do not thrive in that environment. And it's not necessarily, you know, a hardwired, you know, nature versus nurture type of thing. It's not as if I don't think that that person couldn't. It's, I just think that, you know, perhaps they haven't had the experience, or they're just, you know, less ambitious or less motivated to get outside their comfort zone and really learn and do the work and try to like orient themselves in a way that's going to make them successful in that. Cause you know, it is a little bit more nerve wracking. You don't, it's a little bit easier. I mean, it's like, you know, my job is ABC. I show up, I, you know, I do this, I do that. Then I do this and I email this person, then I call this guy. And
then I get home and get to hang out with my family and kids.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, and that's it too. I mean, having a set job description in a lot of ways lets you, you know, leave your, you know, work at the door, and it's a little bit cleaner and more well-defined, but just, yeah, depends on how you manage it.
And those people are so necessary to driving and growing a business. So I forget what personality assessment this is. There's like five types, but there's a character that's called a custodian. There's a, in this personality hierarchy, and these people are what maintain the systems that you erect to keep the whole thing functioning. And those people are so, so critical to keeping the entire thing glued together. Not in like a bureaucratic way, but in like, hey, this is how we do it here. You know, John who just walked in. No, you don't do it like this. You do it like this. And here's why. Those custodial type of people are, I would say, almost as important as the idea, creative, scrappy, you know, every day has a different challenge to tackle kind of character.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. I mean, you can curate the culture and in your values as a company, like I was saying, to a certain extent, by the end of the day, the work has to get done. And there's people in the trenches that are doing that work. And I think back to this thing, the idea of commander's intent, which is a policy, a process that US military uses, because they always say that no military plan survives contact with the enemy. So they say, you can plan all you want. You can put these elaborate plans in place for who's going to do what. And at this point we're going to do this. But as soon as, you know, the enemy,
as soon as you see a fucking
plan,
a bullet whiz by your head, you're like, oh
yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, how your own personnel are reacting, but the, you know, unexpected deviance of the enemy from your particular forecasted plan is going to screw up your plans. And then what, months of work on a particular plan mean that you lose sight of the objective, you lose sight, everything goes off the rails. So I think this idea of commander's intent is simplifying down to like a lowest common denominator. What is the, where do we want to be after this mission, this project, this plan? And everything else kind of cascades down from that. So obviously, you know, there's a lot of important, smart people along the way that have to articulate what it takes to get to that point. But what it does take to get to that point can take different shapes and forms. And I think it's about, like, in a way, upholding that value, upholding those brand standards for the organization while letting people kind of do their work. And to your point, like, these stewards, these people, I mean, they kind of, they're the ones that kind of keep this commander's intent together. It's like, this is what we're going for, guys.
Right.
So it's kind of the glue that keeps it together, but also enables people to be flexible and adaptable to what's really happening out there.
What's interesting is, to me, when we think about brand, any brand I interface with, the strongest brand messaging, the strongest brand briefing, the strongest brand that's off brand, that's on brand, is with spirits partners, because you're in the thing that's sitting in the bottle is juice, is liquid, right? The brand is essentially the value of the company. As good as the spirit tastes, the brand, the wrapper, everything, that's really where the enterprise value of this stuff comes from, especially if we move into stuff like vodka, where you blindfold, you blindfold somebody and they're like, Grey Goose, and they're like, Svedka, you know, like, there's no way that they could do it.
Totally.
So when I think of brand, I wonder if in a sense, the brand is operating as the unshakable commander's intent. It's like, here's the brand, here's the mythology, and here's the story, and here's the criteria that we have to solve. And it's like, the brand is always like kind of guiding the way.
100%. I mean, the brand The brand, yeah, to your point, it depends on the category, and there's product attributes that are marketable and distinguishable, like with the liquid, but yeah, I mean, a lot of times those distinguishable characteristics are really only applicable to experts, people that really know the brand. So trade, for example, if you're talking to a bartender, you can get a little bit more geeky about the flavor notes and the distillation methods and things like that. But the average consumer, a lot of them either don't understand or don't care about that. And compounding that, how do you really communicate that through a lot of the traditional distribution channels that we operate in, like retail? You go to a retail store, how are you going to communicate? Are you really going to drive a conversion of your bottle off the shelf in a sea of other bottles in a liquor store by talking about distillation methods?
Right.
Well, it cascades downwards to, okay, fine, you can blindfold me and I don't know the difference, but guess what? How often do I get blindfolded? I'm not answering that question. Okay.
Handcuffed?
Not often. Okay. Not often. So it's almost ridiculous to say that, because number one, it undermines the consumer, who's very smart and decides whether you live or die. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So when we do this blind, hey, you don't know the difference between Grey Goose and cheap crap. It's like, well, you know what? The experience when you see the bottle, when you see where it comes on the high part of the shelf, when you know you've just paid $60, $70, right? That's all setting up your palate in a sense, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, all these things.
You haven't even opened the freaking bottle yet, and you just are going, I know this is going to be good.
Yeah, and you can't undermine that stuff. I mean, obviously, people want to point to what it is that really differentiates, but it's to your point, these are experiential products. I mean, you can't discount the...
I'm not discounting. I'm saying it's more important than anything.
No, I agree with you. Like, you drink $1,000 wine out of an IKEA wine cup,
right?
You know, or a Solo cup.
Shout out to Sweden. We love you.
Yeah, no bashing on IKEA. I've got plenty of their products.
Like your bed.
Yeah, no longer in college, fortunately. But yeah, I mean, that totally changes the game. I mean, the whole experience. I mean, this is like, you see Louis XIII, they've developed this ritual. The waiter comes to your table with the white gloves.
Comes out of a freaking cabinet that's nicer than, like, you know, the cabinet I have in my house.
The rich mahogany box, the siphon that they put it into your, you know, stemmed glass.
They invented that siphon, that thing?
I'm not sure if they invented or not, but
silver.
It's definitely, yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, but this is why brands want to create these rituals, is because it's about elevating the experience. And all, you know, while the liquid, you know, can stand alone as a unique product that really wins people's hearts, it's about
the whole fanfare package.
Yeah. The pack, everything, the name, everything about it is, you know, feeding into your point. It's kind of like the pre-read for the initial sip.
Right. It's almost like, we all have like a friend who's like a badass and you haven't met him, and they're like, that, you know, everyone before he gets to the table, they're like, that guy's a badass. That guy drives the coolest car, whatever it is, right? It's almost like your brand is your reputation before you even sit down and try the thing, meet the thing.
Of course. Yeah. And if, you know, that's why negative PR can be so catastrophic for brands, because even if you have fundamentally a great product, you know, if people's perception of you is tainted, then it's really hard to overcome that. I mean,
where does that happen in spirits? I'm trying to think, like,
well, I mean, one example that comes to mind is in, you know, the Australian wine business, for example. I mean, you see what's happened with Yellowtail. Yellowtail has become synonymous with Australian wine, which is, as a provenance, as a point of origin, is, you know, one of the most amazing wine producers globally. I mean, it's, you know, some of the finest wines globally come from Australia.
But their success and their market saturation has taken down the market from a price point standpoint. Like, hey, this is Aussie wine. You can't charge me more than $12. I know better, kind of thing.
Yes, and not so much that. It's more just the consumer perception of Australian wine is that it is less premium. So they're less, you know, they go to a restaurant or they go to a wine shop, they're looking at, you know, looking to spend $50 to $100. They're looking at French, they're looking at Spanish, Italian, you know, they're looking at Napa.
Isn't it amazing how countries can have a living, breathing brand around their products that command a higher price?
Yeah.
So your country is a brand wrapper, and then there's your product, right? It's like making a leather good and you're saying, we are the finest leather goods from New Jersey. Yeah. Like, I'm out. Like,
maybe, yeah, choose a different point of origin there.
Right. But what's interesting is we are the finest pizza in New Jersey. Okay, I'm listening now.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like brand, it's like product specific. And you kind of have to play within that. Do you think that the Venezuelan heritage is something that's so core? I mean, it's unique. I don't know, for you guys.
Yeah, yeah. I think point of origin is huge in some products. It's super important with wine. I think it's, you know, with tequila, I mean, all tequila has to legally be produced in Mexico. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's not a lot of
Jalisco.
Jalisco, not a lot of variation there. But I think with rum, there's less importance. So I think it matters a little bit less to consumers, the point of origin story. I do. I mean, there's a brand around Caribbean rum for sure.
Right. I mean, basically just a brand around being a pirate in general.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
If you're a pirate, you can sell rum.
Yeah. Yeah. The history of Jack Sparrow and, you know, rum, the Caribbean. I mean, yeah, there's, you know, that's not necessarily good for premium products either, but, without a doubt. I mean, there's an understanding that rum from that part of the world is high, is good. I mean, that's where kind of rum comes from.
Basically where sugar grows.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. You know, sugar cane is basically a weed and, you know, it'll grow really well in that, you know, damp, humid environment, you know? So, yeah, I think the Venezuelan origin, certainly, I mean, Venezuela is very much a Caribbean Caribbean country in terms of climate. Right. It actually has the longest Caribbean coast of any Caribbean country. And the climate is very similar to what you see in Martinique and Barbados and some of these more prominent rum origins that people kind of know.
Right.
In the U.S., especially, you know, for better or for worse, I mean, you know, with all the Venezuelans that have come to the United States, with everything that's going on there,
right.
Being a Venezuelan product, especially one of, you know, that is successful and, you know, able to access, has, you know, benefited the brand, certainly.
Right. What's the story? This is just a personal question that I'm dying to know, because like, when you guys, we talk about brand and transmitting the language of this brand, influencer marketing still hot, you know, I'm still here, everybody. Influencer marketing is still hot. Why, how do you approach that challenge? Like at a company like Diplomatico, when you're, you know, when you're, you have to be so careful. I mean, financial, you know, fintech companies that hire me, they have to be careful. But when you're dealing with this, like, oh, there's so much heritage to the brand. It's like, you know, it, in if we want to jump over to like, it's like a Louis Vuitton or Hermes, whatever, in the fashion world, they have to be so tight and careful. Like, has influencer marketing like been successful for you guys? Is it something that you, it's part of your mix?
You want to be careful, but I mean, I think there's a tendency among any business operator or leader, and especially among marketers, to be too careful, but super restrained in how they operate, you know, because marketers, you know, it's about consistency. It's about detail. It's about, you know, the little things. And, you know, we hone in and drill down to a level that most normal people aren't even going to notice.
Okay.
So I think you want to be super careful and protect your brand and make sure that you're promoting it in the ways that are true to that heritage, like you're saying. But I also think that there's without a doubt, I mean, without a doubt, brands like Louis Vuitton and Hermes, yes, they've become successful by, you know, deliberately building their distribution, controlling their distribution, controlling where they're promoted, how they're promoted. But it's also how they've become so synonymous in culture. I mean, you know, the way that.
Right. Everything from rap videos to really tasteful, you know, these fashion entrepreneurs or these fashion influencers, which have these beautiful lifestyle pages, everything in between.
Yeah. And was, you know, being in rap videos, you know, first on the marketing priorities list when the Hermes marketing team was sitting down thinking about how they wanted to really promote their heritage. Probably not, but you know,
but it freaking works.
Yeah, it works. And these brands have become so synonymous in these lifestyle circles that, you know, it perpetuates their success, and something you have to be careful with, but also something you have to, you know, think in innovative ways about, and what does the future really look like and how do we get there? But I think to your question, influencer marketing, influencer marketing is still a key component for us. You know, a key part of the paid media mix. I think paid media is changing in a lot of ways. You look at what e-commerce has become in the industry, which is not just about driving conversion. It's also about driving awareness and, you know, just engagement with people, you know, and qualified shopper online. And, you know, I think influencer marketing has changed a lot. You know, I think maybe initially it was more of a, you know, a veiled organic way of reaching consumers. Right. You know, it's like, you know, this person really loves the brand. They must, you know, it must be good. And I think,
well, before video, it literally was a static image of you with the brand in some kind of lifestyle environment or whatever it is that you're doing. Now we're, you know, it's a video world. So yeah. Your storytelling, number one, it gets harder to do. Most people can't do that, right? So a lot of these people get booted out of that influencer market because they can't translate what they do to video. But now, holy shit, now we have to, now we're part of your ecosystem telling your story. It gets a little, it gets deeper now.
Yeah. I mean, there's without a doubt, video is more impactful in my, well, it depends, but in this particular case, I think it's way more impactful.
It's way more impactful.
Yeah. And, and obviously Instagram and these, you know, these other social media networks are prioritizing videos. So, you know, you have a higher efficiency oftentimes in terms of your reach and engagement. But I think, you know, even though consumers, I think, have become a little bit more desensitized to the content in the sense that they don't view it as like this true organic endorsement, I do think that there's a ton of value in it. And I think it's something that for us is really important, particularly as we think about for alcohol, what does the next generation of drinkers really look like? Because I know that, you know, a lot of Gen Z, younger drinkers are the ones that are really, you know, engaging and taking stock in, you know.
Right.
It depends on the influencer. Certainly, I would imagine your audience is a bit older. But
More handsome is what I've been told.
Yeah. Well, that's
one of the best looking audiences. That's the metric that matters for you guys.
Does Instagram give you that metric?
Is how good. Yeah, it does. I'm in the top. Yeah. Top 1% there. I'm pretty sure. So influencer marketing is like, in my opinion, a really cheap, quick way to stay current, because what you're doing is you're taking your brand and letting it filter through someone who is literally on the front lines of culture, of humor, of whatever is going viral. It's like, holy shit, you don't have to do any work. You get to take a basket of these people you think are a good fit and start to seed them or fund them and say, okay, let's give it a shot. You know, you do have to do work, obviously. And I know that managing influencers can feel like herding cats at some point, because you're, instead of facing off against one agency, you're facing off against 15 micro agencies, basically. But I think what it allows you to do, it's like auto current, like you're like, and here I am, I'm current, I'm on the front lines now, and let's see what happens. And it's the reaction is immediate. The information that you get back is probably immediate. Maybe not in something that's not e-commerce like spirits, but man, I think like entertainment, I think knowledge sharing, everything is getting more distilled and molecular to, here's my marketing influencer that I like, here's my fashion, and everyone's mix is different.
Yeah, I mean, it's a way to insert yourself into a more of a real lifestyle conversation as opposed to the traditional digital advertising vehicles, which are, you know, still effective at driving awareness. But I think it's a little further, you know, the influencer aspect's a little further down the funnel. It's driving that emotional connectivity with the brand, that more occasion oriented, like, how do I drink this product? You know, what, you know, in what cool ways can I enjoy this product or insert it into my life or insert it into my, you know, whatever, studio time, you know, celebration with friends. You know, we talk a lot about, you know, we partner a lot with people that are like, you know, our message is passion, craft, like telling people stories about how they came up, how they prioritize what makes them happy, what drives them in life. And, you know, this kind of moment of celebration, this moment of recollection, of reflection is kind of, we're trying to kind of capitalize on that and insert the brand into that.
Yeah.
Into that conversation.
And the variety of occasions, like for me, when I did the spot for you guys, for Reels, TikTok and all that stuff. Well, no, Reels and YouTube Shorts. It was, you know, for me, that occasion was that Friday wind down, right? It wasn't, that's how I roll, right? So, you know, the 20 person dinner party, not that this, it was like this quieter kind of wind down, this personal reflection moment. And, and that's how I ran with the brand brief that you guys shared with me.
Yeah, that was great. Actually, I think,
it was really great, actually, right?
Yeah. Tastes great.
It was great.
Feels great.
You're probably one of your favorite Did you say that before the show? You said it was actually your favorite.
I think I said it was the best ever. Those are my words.
In the whole 20 years. Yeah, guys, pretty sure that you said that. So
coming back for seconds.
Continue.
Yeah. No, influencer marketing is great, and interested to see where it goes because it's
me too
becoming pretty saturated. Mm-hmm. And you know, with alcohol, it's like a whole nother thing about responsibility and age gating and ensuring mm-hmm. that the right people are viewing your content.
So. And there's just certain platforms you can't even talk about it on. Like you can't talk about TikTok. Alcohol on TikTok, period.
Unfortunately, it seems like a miss on their part that they haven't really,
I don't think they
be top of the priority list for them.
Yeah. And I think it would require a huge shift in the way that the platform onboards people to make sure who's over 18. There's a whole different way that those guys build the onboarding process. I'm assuming that's why they've just said no thanks.
Yeah.
I mean, where do I think influencer marketing is going to head? I think the influencers, like, you know, back in the day, you watched your favorite TV show, like, you know, you watched like Full House or something. What was like a good TV? Who was the one with Steve Urkel? What was that called? Family Matters?
No. Cosby, not the Cosby Show.
All right. Clearly we need to completely remember what happened during our childhood. But the bottom line is, like, I think with influencers and digital creators, this whole world, the creator has to grow up with the audience. Like, nobody wants the creator stuck in the past. I think everyone wants that creator to grow up and evolve. So where things were in this really comedy centric, skit centric way, and I think we're already pulling away from that. Like, that's how fast things are moving. Mm-hmm. We're talking like 2 years fast. Like, okay, that was the creator, the skit, the humor, the dance. Remember dancing? Dude, no one's doing dancing anymore, right? So these trends move fast, and I think an audience to stick around, they want to see the creator grow up and evolve and change. And I think bring a deeper experience to use the ultimate example, like the biggest TikToker ever that started with dancing.
Not sure.
Charlie D'Amelio. Okay. Charlie D'Amelio, you know, was this, I think, the largest, most followed account on TikTok. She was basically the person that built TikTok as the dancing viral, you know, dance along with me, share your takes, like, and she's just slowly growing up and evolving into, it's more about her life. Like, she has a reality show, and you bring in people closer and closer. And dude, I think that this is really interesting because now you have an influencer who has a closer audience. They're growing up. They get to be more creative, not doing the same old thing. And the brand gets to engage with them as they grow up and evolve. Mm-hmm. and can bring that product into the conversation in a meaningful way. This is good for you guys.
Yeah, for sure.
I think.
Yeah, I think because there's ways to tap into different aspects of that journey. But I think you're spot on because, I mean, at the end of the day, we can't forget that influencers are brands, really. I mean, it's very personified, and it's the expression of a brand through an individual's personality or particular style of content. But at the end of the day, they are their brand, they are their business, and brands inherently have to evolve in order to stay relevant. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, there's so many crazy brands out there that in their time were so dominant, and you know, you couldn't imagine life without them. And where are they now? You know,
right.
You know? So, I totally agree that, evolving and, adapting to new trends and new demands from consumers is an important way for you to, you know, stay relevant, also feel rewarded, and for all to feel rewarded about the kind of the content that they're doing.
Right. I think if you're a creator, you should be comfortable shifting and growing, just like a band has to change and evolve and not play the same frickin' style of music over and over and over again. Right.
Yeah.
And if you're a brand, to embrace the changing, shifting landscape, that the only thing constant is change in media. Mm-hmm. It seems as though that's a fact, right? And I think everyone continues to win because the market is so freaking efficient. You know, the entertainment's only going to get more entertaining. The touch points are only going to get more personal. So I think everyone is truly getting more of what they want. The only thing that we have, I guess, on the dark side is, you know, and don't ask me how to solve this problem. I have no freaking idea. Is like, okay, well, now we're, how much time are we going to spend on our phones? Like, is there going to be a cultural pushback around that at some point? We keep saying there's going to be, by the way, and it never happens.
Yeah.
On a personal level, I keep saying I'm going to do that, and it doesn't happen.
Yeah. I don't know. I there's a lot of, you know, theories out there around that. I hope so. Mm-hmm. On a personal level, I hope so. Screens are taking over our lives. I'm already, you know, on a personal level.
On a brand perspective, continue to engage.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, on a personal level, I am, you know, creating guardrails for myself and, you know, right. Saying, okay, today, no TV, no, you know, put my phone down, you know, charge it in the other room.
Right. No ice cream.
Get away. Yeah. No bugles.
Right.
But
no pizza bagels in the freezer. Like, you've really cut out your personal
no more challenge. Toaster shakings. Yeah. But from a brand perspective, yeah, it's, you know, all these touch points have provided like a whole new world for brands. I mean, it's confusing, but also a crazy opportunity because, you know, the rule book for marketing has been flipped, you know, they've flipped the script on, you know, everything people, you know, knew about marketing in terms of the fundamentals.
Right.
You have to adapt all this new technology, new ways of analyzing data, utilizing data. There's all these devices now, connected TV, podcasts like this, you know, there's so many ways to reach people now. And now because things are so saturated, you rely on those touch points to reach people because you have to reach them exponentially more times for them to actually pay attention to you. So,
right.
You know, do I hope that, you know, people back off the screens and, you know, reconnect with reality a little bit? I hope so personally, but, you know, from a marketing standpoint, there's a lot to be gleaned from, you know, people's consumption of technology.
Right. It's a good environment for brands as long as you're evolving and you're staying current and you're willing to run new experiments.
Yeah. It's tough. It's really been a challenge. You know, technology evolves so fast. I mean, you see regulators can't even stay on top of Facebook and these, you know, companies to regulate them. They don't understand the technology.
Right.
And I think a lot of marketers, you know, they find their little niches or things that they do and, you know, they do them really well, but, you know, technology is changing so fast. Algorithms are changing so fast. I mean, that's another challenge. I mean, and reason to continue updating content as well, not just consumer demands, but the algorithms. I mean, they're changing like crazy every year,
right?
Multiple times a year, they're changing. And
there's really nothing you can do about it. Like,
no.
So I take the stoic approach there. I'm like, I cannot change the algorithm. So I just going to keep doing me hopefully that's good enough. You
For
know,
sure.
What does really rich mean to you?
I think, it's an approach to life and to business that is a little bit more conscious. You know, I think that the rich personality that you kind of talk about is kind of like the self-obsessed, narcissistic, you know, and most importantly, I think unkind individual that is driven certainly and successful, but has lost sight of what really matters.
Right.
Why are we doing all this? You know, why are we getting up and going to work? No one's holding a gun to our head. I mean, obviously to live in society, we need a little bit of cash in order to pay the rent. But I do think that people in this journey of ambitious, trying to be successful, trying to make money, trying to get to the top, they lose sight of the people around them.
Right.
What really matters, why we're doing it. So I think that approach to you can be successful, not necessarily compromise all these other important aspects that give life meaning. So.
Right. And my argument is you can be even more successful when you take care of the people around you. So I know you on a personal level, man. I think you're a really rich character as far as I'm concerned.
Thanks,
I think that's the pod, everyone. If you haven't subscribed yet, click the subscribe button.
Do it.
Click the like button. Alex Fellows, thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks, buddy.
All right. Most importantly, I want to shout out the people that gave 5 stars to the podcast. We're a new podcast. Okay. We need all the love we can get. So here we go. We've got Lee. Thanks, Lee. 5 stars. You rock. Willie. Thank you, sir. Ethan, you rock. Eliana, always a pleasure. Joel, amazing. Raphael, you're the best. Lee, I think Lee actually tried to do it twice. Shout out to you again, Lee, for just trying to blow up the system, get those extra stars in.
Extra credit.
Extra credit. And my favorite name on the list, Darko.
Donnie Darko.
No, Darko. I'm not going to say your last name because I'm pretty sure that would expose your identity, Darko, because how many Darkos are there? Darko, thank you. And it, wait, one more. Diego. Thank you, Diego. You guys rock. Thanks for putting 5 stars on the podcast. And by the way, if you're one of those people that maybe want to put 5 stars on the podcast too.
It's the first thing I'm doing when I leave here.
That's right. Alex is going to do it. You should do it. I'll shout you out too.